We begin this evening, B'Sha Tova, our 18th year in the weekly Shir. And you may be surprised to hear that there is yet one or two things to say. So we look forward, Mitzvah Hashem, to a year of Torah learning, Torah growth, together. Parshas Bereishis, we had to use our own resources, but we open up the Chumash together here with Parshas Noach. Noach begins, interestingly, just as the phrases that we're used to when we have our natural translations for. Eile told us Noach, the very introductory words of the Parsha. These are told us Noach. What does the word toldos mean? And here, in fact, there are three different interpretations amongst the Rishonim. Rashi, of course, famously understands, and I think for if we only know one Perush, this would probably be it, that toldos means children, from the word yoled. Toldos Noach is presenting Noach's children. In fact, as we know, it's for this reason that Rashi is bothered by the fact that the Torah opens with the words Eile toldos Noach, but then does not actually tell us about his children until the next pasuk. It interrupts to talk about Noach. Noach was a tzaddik, and he was tamim, v'derosav, etc. Rashi's quotation from Chazal, that having mentioned Noach, the pasuk must speak in his praise. Eile toldos Noach, and as soon as we hear the word Noach, you've got to talk about what a tzaddik Noach was and then get back to the subject at hand, which raises all sorts of questions, and it's something that we've discussed in previous years. But all of this is a product of the fact that Rashi interprets the word toldos as his sons. If the pasuk introduces his sons, what are they doing in the next pasuk? The Sforno explains that the word toldos doesn't refer to people. It refers to the events of Noach's life. Koros Yemei Chayov. What happened to him? And in fact, this is a usage of the word toldos that we find in the pasuk. Ki lo teida mayeled yom. Al tishalel liyom machar, says Shlomo HaMelech in Mishlei. Don't have grandiose plans for tomorrow. Lo teida mayeled yom. You don't even know what today will beget. And therefore, the toldos of the day, or the toldos of the lives of Noach. And therefore the pasuk is really introducing the entire parsha, not three individuals, but rather all of Parsha's Noach. These are the events of Noach's life. And a third interpretation is to be found with the Rashbam, the grandson of Rashi, Rabbeinu Shmuel ben Meir. And he's closer to Rashi in a sense that toldos do refer to people, it's not events. But which people? Rashbam explains that the word toldos, and it's an interesting point, because there exists a word for children, and children are called bonim, and toldos are also, it's a related term, yelet. But toldos, says the Rashbam, is beyond his sons. Toldos refers to the future generations, bonov ubnei bonov. And therefore, interestingly, not like Rashi, for Rashi toldos are his son specifically, and we find later on in Parshas toldos, when the pasuk introduces Ve'ele toldos Yitzchak, Rashi says Yaakov and Esav, and they are his toldos. And there the Rashbam also says, no, Ve'ele toldos Yitzchak refers to all the generations that came from Yitzchak, not only Yaakov and Esav, but Yaakov's children and Esav's children, which are described variously in Parshas Vayishlach and Parshas Vayigash. All of that is covered by the expression Eile toldos Yitzchak. And similarly here in Parshas Noach, for the first half of the Parsha, it's about Noach and his sons. But the end of the Parsha, it's about everyone that came from them. They are all covered by the introduction of Eile toldos Noach. The 70 nations of the world are toldos Noach. So thus we have before us, even as we are opening the Parsha, how exactly to understand the introductory words of Eile toldos Noach, who or what are they introducing, and how far do we need to read in order to find the subjects that they are discussing. Now, a well-known feature of the Teva that Noach is to build is to be found in Perek Vav, Pasuk Tet Zayin. HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Noach to build the Teva, and then says, Tzohar ta'aseh l'teva. He is to make a Tzohar. Now, Tzohar itself is from the word Tzohar, Zohar, Tzaharayim. It's a source of light, something that will provide light. What exactly is this Tzohar? What exactly is Noach to do? And as we know, there are two famous approaches to the word Tzohar that are quoted by Rashi. There are more in the Medrash, actually, but Rashi quotes, some say that Tzohar is a window, Yesh Omrim Chalon, which lets the light in, the Yesh Omrim Even Tova Hame'ir Lehem. And some say that it's a luminous stone that will provide light. So is it a window or is it a stone? That is the question. And Mefarshei Rashi are working very hard to understand why it would be one, why it would be the other, why Rashi would quote both. And is there any way that we can perhaps find evidence to support one interpretation over the other? Something that I did not find Mefarshei Rashi discussing so much, one of the later Mefarshim asked the question, he didn't answer it, but it's a very interesting point to consider in this parsha. You see, if we take a step back from this pasuk of Tzohar ta'aseh l'teva, and we look at the collection of psukim, as Noach is told to make the teva, we will discover, or we will note, that actually there are two categories of instruction. The first relates to the construction of the teva itself. What does it look like? What is it made of? How big should it be? And then, in the fullness of time, there are the subsequent psukim are about what should it contain, how much food, etc. If we find, for example, from the beginning of Pasuk Yudalit, Asei lecha tevas atzei gopher, it should be made of gopher wood, kinim, it should be arranged into rooms, it should be smeared with pitch outside and in. And then the next pasuk tesvav, are its dimensions, shlosh miyazama, orech hateva, and 50 wide and 30 high. So that is, these two psukim are about how to build the teva. Later on, pasuk yotes is about who to bring into the teva, right? All of the animals, two by two. Pasuk kaf aleph is what to bring into the teva. Food. In other words, you'll bring in the animals and bring in food, and that's what you'll put into the teva. The reason why I make a point of distinguishing between these two types of instructions is because now, when we look back at the word Tzohar ta'aseh l'teva, let us see where do they reside. Which type of psukim are they to be found in? Actually, they are. The Tzohar is in Pasuk Tet Zayin, which is yet discussing the construction of the Teva. Tzohar ta'aseh l'teva. Whatever Tzohar is, it's at the beginning of Tet Zayin, provide light. And then the Pasuk proceeds to discuss the construction of the Teva. Ve'lamot techalena melamala, the roof should slope upwards to an amma, and it should be three stories high. All of these are specifications as to how the Teva is to be made. And therefore, one may perhaps wonder, is this not support, if not more than support, compelling evidence, for the understanding that the Tzohar is a window? Because a window is a part of the construction of the ark. I mean, windows were not as high-tech in those days as they are now. It's essentially a hole in the wall. But nonetheless, it's in the wall. As opposed to the Even Tova, which seems to accrue more to things that you bring in. You bring in food to eat, you bring in the animals for safekeeping, and you bring in this Even Tova for light. And this was a question that bothered me for a while. It's a very interesting question, because if you look at the word Tzohar from here until further notice, the question doesn't happen. But if you sweep through the psukim and then look back at Tzohar, all of a sudden, you wonder whether its location doesn't give it away as to what exactly the Tzohar is. I believe perhaps one may suggest the following answer. There is a very startling comment of the Medrash. It's certainly one of those cases where if the Medrash didn't say it, no one else could say it. And people try. But it relates to a pasuk in Tehillim, in Perek Hei. The pasuk describes all sorts of wrongdoings. The words of the pasuk are Te'abed Dovrei Kozov. This is the pasuk talking to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Te'abed, with an aleph. Te'abed, you destroy Dovrei Kozov, people who are false. Ish Domim Umirma Yisa'ev Hashem, a person of blood, a person of deceit, Hashem detests. Says the Medrash, that is a description of the generation of the flood. They were false, they were violent, they were deceitful, they were all of those things, and they were destroyed. Okay. The next pasuk says, I'm not sure how familiar the first pasuk is, but the very next pasuk is very familiar to us. Va'ani barav chastecha avaveisecha. The question is, what is the flow and what is the connection between the wrongdoings discussed in the first pasuk of Noah's generation and the next word, because the next verse refers to Noah. Va'ani barav chastecha avaveisecha. What is the meaning of the word va'ani? Now, I think our intuition would tell us that the vav here, va'ani v'rav chastecha, doesn't really connect Noach to them, because he's, of course, so different than they are. But it does say vav, and therefore the respectable, and this may well be pshat, translation of the word va'ani is, as for me, or but as for me. Rather, I, v'rav chastecha v'vesecha, so it's an interesting and, because it's the separating and. That's the pshat. It has to be. What's very interesting is the Medrash makes no such tweaking of the letter Vav. Vav looks like it means and it means and. Which means that what Noach is saying is they did all of those things, Va'ani and me. Now, before we get to what exactly that may mean, we do see just in terms of approach, once again, the most important point to be aware of. And that is the difference between pshat and drash, which we speak of often. It's a oversimplification and sometimes misrepresentation to say that the difference between the pshat and the drash is that the pshat translates literally, shall we say, and the drash is the non-literal translation. That's not true. Sometimes that is the opposite of the truth. Because sometimes if you translate it literally, you have an awkward result. And therefore the smoother path, the more straightforward path, is sometimes the non-literal translation. Vayisyatzvu betachtis hahar. As we know, when the Jewish people, when they approached Har Sinai, the pasuk says, Vayisyatzvu betachtis hahar. What is the meaning of tachtis hahar, of Har Sinai? Well, the word tachas literally means underneath. But on a pshat level, why would they be underneath the mountain? And therefore the pshat clearly is at the foot of the mountain, even though the pasuk doesn't say at the foot of the mountain, it says underneath the mountain, but we understand that underneath means not directly underneath. At the foot of the mountain. Okay, that's a non-literal translation, which is acceptable, aderech hapshat. It's the drash that proceeds to translate the word tachtis literally. It looks like it means underneath. It does mean underneath. Melamed shekafa lemesa HaKadosh Baruch Hu sahar kegigas, that Hashem suspended the mountain over them. So the drash rushes in where the pshat fears to tread. Because it's such a startling notion, if you don't have the capability of handling it, you can't translate it that way. But the drash, of course, has much outside information at its disposal as to what it could possibly mean. But the pshat must say that it means at the foot of the mountain, which is a safe and straightforward translation. Similarly here, the simple understanding of vav is to connect. Except al derech hapshat, how could you connect these two? I mean, they're opposites, they're contrasted, not compared. But the drash says no. The pasuk means to say they did all those terrible things, va'ani, and so did I. The words of the Medrash, ka'asher osu, kein osisi. Whatever they did, I did as well. So, we may be wondering if Noach is, I mean, it's his own words, but let's take him at his word, if he is as guilty as the other members of his generation, so how come he made it into the Teva and they didn't? How come he was singled out to build the Teva and no one else was? So he says, Va'ani, the answer is, Barov chastacha of Ovesecha, you were kind to me. You told me to come to the Teva. Were it not for the kindness, I would have been swept away with the others. Now, again, these are Noah's words, so we don't know if the Pasuk would endorse them, perhaps Noah is being overly humble. What could it possibly mean that he is guilty as they are, Va'ani? Well, we have seen in the past, the Beis Halevi discusses at length that it could be that Noah was not immune to the negative forces which were rampant in his generation. And therefore, he's a tzaddik because were it not for those negative forces, he never would have initiated negative behavior. But we don't know that he was immune to being impacted by that atmosphere, perhaps. So they did all those terrible things of their own volition. Va'ani. And I couldn't remain completely immune. The Yifei Toar, one of the Mefarshi HaMedrash of Shmuel Yafa Ashkenazi, explains, and again, these are delicate discussions, but Noach says of himself that he was guilty of the things that his generation was, is because he felt, looking back, that he could have prevented it. That is to say, as we know, the Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos and Daf Nun Hey, if someone has the power to prevent a wrongdoing, they are indicted to a degree for that wrongdoing. They're held responsible. Noach, as we know, it's a very difficult question, but the fact is that Noach is criticized in Chazal for not rebuking his generation, for not trying to turn them around, or at least to bring them into the Teva. Lo hochiach es b'nei doro. He did not rebuke the members of his generation. It is true, we should know, that that doesn't mean that he did not say anything to them. He was forced to talk to them. He was forced to talk to them because he was forced to build an ark for years and years in plain view of everyone, which will definitely spark discussion, at least after a while. And at the point where they said, why are you building the Teva? So the answer was, he didn't hide it from them because there will be a marble, so he did discuss it with them. Rashi says, Pasuk Yudalit, Asei lecha teva satzei gofer. You've got to make a teva, says Rashi. There's plenty of ways to save Noach. If the object of the exercise is to save Noach, he doesn't need to build an ark. We should remember, the Gemara says in Maseches Vachim and Daf Kuf Yud Gimel, that the Mabel did not affect Eretz Yisrael. The waters did not enter Eretz Yisrael. Basing itself on the Pasuk in Yechezkel, which discusses Eretz Yisrael, and says, Lo gushma biyom za'am. It was not rained upon on the day of wrath. That's the Mabel, and Eretz Yisrael was not affected. Which means Noach, he could have just gone to Eretz Yisrael for a year, and he would have been fine. But Hashem kept him where he was and told him to build an ark. That's a lot of hammering. Why? Kedei sheyiruhu anshei dor hamabel osek ba kuf kaf shana. It took a long time, 120 years. It's a long time. And people will see him. V'sholen oso, mazos lecha. And they'll say, what are you doing? Maha avoda hazos lachem. Behu omer lahem. And he would say to them, he's meant to tell them, Asa HaKadosh Baruch Hu, lahavi mabel le'olam. To tell them about the flood. Ulai yashuva, maybe they'll do tshuva. Well, maybe. In the end, they didn't. So what's very interesting is, the building of the Teva is not to save Noach, because Noach could have been saved in any other number of ways. The building of the Teva is a call to his generation to better their ways. No one heeded the call. There is a fascinating comment, it's a subtle point, which is mentioned by the Lubavitcher Rebbe Zatzal in one of his sichas, whereby he points out, for Rashi is commenting that Noah has to make the Teva so that people will see. How does Rashi know that this is the case? How does Rashi know that when Hashem tells Noah to make the Teva, it's for the benefit of his generation? Maybe it is just to save Noah. There will be a flood. How does Rashi see there's more to it than saving Noah and his family? Says the Rebbe very elegantly. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says to Noah in Pasuk Yud Gimel, Ketz kol basar ba lefanai. The end of all flesh has come before me, ki mal'ah ha'aretz chomas b'pneim, v'hineni mashkei samas ha'aretz, and I will destroy them.
How?
Doesn't say. Very interesting. He says they'll destroy them, but, and now we know the answer will be through a flood. That will come in Pasuk Yud Zayin. I'm going to bring a flood. So it's very interesting. How come HaKadosh Baruch Hu first says he's going to destroy them in Pasuk Yud Gimel, and then says he's going to bring a flood in Pasuk Yud Zayin? But those are the same thing. And what's in between? The commandment to build the Teva. What's it doing in between the statement that the world will be destroyed and that it will be through a flood? Says the Rebbe, the answer is that had HaKadosh Baruch Hu said firstly that he would bring a flood and then tell Noach to build the Teva, the implication would be that the sum total of what the Teva is about is a response to the flood. It's a flood, you need to be in an ark. And therefore HaKadosh Baruch Hu says there will be trouble, but he tells Noach to build the Teva before he tells him that there will be a flood, in order to indicate that there is value and meaning to the building of the Teva before the flood happens, because it's actually for the 120 intervening years, not just for when the flood finally happens, if it happens. So that's a very, once again, attention to the flow of the psukim, whereby to be told to build the Teva before even being told about the flood, that gives an understanding that there is significance and purpose to the building, even before we get to the flood. So Noach has been building, and people have been asking, and Noach has been answering, and no one has really paid any attention. How can it be? It seems that the problem wasn't that Noach didn't talk to anyone about it, but it doesn't really seem like he was trying to convince anyone. It doesn't really sound like his heart was in it. Because for 120 years, even if you're not on a budget, and no results, that something is missing. And it seems that Chazal are saying that what was missing was a Noah's point. And again, as we proceed in this very delicate discussion, there is a further comment of the Medrash on the words kinim ta'aseh sateva, which is in Pasuk Yudalit, Haseilecha Teva Satei Gofer, Kinim Taaseh Sateva. Kinim means cells, ken. It should be made into rooms, compartments. But the Medrash says there's another message to the word kinim. Kinim is a bird's nest, Kansipur. And moreover, there's a specific connotation of the word kinim. It refers to sets of birds that are bought as korbanos. There's a Masechta of Mishnayos, Maseches Kinim. It's all about those birds, certain people who are in a state of tuma, in order to achieve a state of tara. Part of what they do, they go to a mikveh, but they also bring these two kinim, one for an ola, one for a Torah ben Yonah, the whole, all of those complicated details. Says the Medrash, and again, it's being very harsh here. Noach was told to make the teva as kinim, because the making of the teva and being in the teva was a purifying process for Noach. Just like future generations would bring a pair of birds to become pure, Noach needed to enter the Teva to become pure. Melamed shehaya tzarech tahara k'metzora. He needed to be purified like a metzora. So that's quite a thing to say on the word kinim. Kinim is like Maseches Kinim, with a kuf. Why does Noach need tahara? What does he need to be purified from? And moreover, again, without going into the details, but a Metzora is not the only person who gets his Tahara through a set of birds. There are other types of categories of Tumah. So if the point is that for some reason he's impure, whatever that means, and needs to become pure through a bird, how do we know he's impure like a Metzora? But it seems clear that Chazal are referring to his impurity as a Metzora, because Noah was considered to be like a Metzora. The problem of a Metzora is that he speaks Lashon Hara. The question is, where do we find that Noah ever spoke Lashon Hara? In what way is he like a Metzora? I think that when we consider the possibilities of the violation of Lashon Hara is first and foremost verbal, but it's possible to violate Lashon Hara also, as the Paskim tell us, the Chofetz Chaim, through actions, and sometimes through lack of action. As if to say, when Moshe was first told to redeem, go and redeem the Jewish people, he said they would not believe him. V'hein lo yaminu li. And he was punished for that. How does he know? He was sure they wouldn't believe him. Noach, it seems, if he's told to build a teva, and he does, and he's meant to spark up conversation, which presumably he does, but no one bites. No one either does tshuva, or no one enters the ark, at least to cover their bases. They can always leave again if nothing happens. No one even thought it was worth a try. It seems that the attitude in Noah's discussions with them was that of, it doesn't make a difference, there's no point. They won't believe me. They won't believe me, or there's no hope for them. And therefore, it was with half a heart. So no one was convinced. And therefore, that on Noah's level is Lashon Hara. To engage a person and try and rebuke them half-heartedly, where the tone of what you're saying is that there is no hope for you, is essentially Lashon Hara. It's passive Lashon Hara. And therefore, Noah, on his level, needed the purification of Kinim, like in Mitzora, for that passive Lashon Hara. Moshe Rabbeinu, who's often compared with Noah in this way, because Noah, on the one hand, it seems, did not put himself out enough for his generation. Moshe initially says v'hein le'yaminu li, but beyond that, those early stages, there's nothing that he wouldn't do for the Jewish people, until he gets to the point where he's prepared to nullify his existence for the benefit of the Jewish people. Mecheini no misifrocha, he says to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if you don't forgive them, delete me from your book. Mecheini. The Navi itself refers to the flood as Mei Noach. It's the Haftarah for Parshas Noach. Ki Mei Noach Zosli. And Mei Noach, says the Medrash, means because it's called Noach's water because Noach is considered responsible. He could have avoided it. Ad Kedeka. So that's the expression used in the Pasuk, Mei Noach. And as the Zohar Kodesh points out, when Moshe Rabbeinu later on does put himself out for his generation, he does so with the word mecheni. Mecheni means delete me for their good. Mecheni, says the Zohar, is an amalgamation of the letters of the two words Mei Noach. Mem Yud Nun Chet. Mei Noach is mecheni. And the reason why these discussions are important is not just to make ourselves feel better and have someone to criticize at the Shabbos table. It's in order to ensure that we're learning from Noah. It's worth it if it causes us to raise the question, do we put ourselves out for the people in our generation? Noah didn't have anyone to learn from. We do. He's called Noah. So these are the perspectives on that very unusual comment in the Medrash, which says, Va'ani. They were guilty, I was guilty, by association, so that I could have prevented it. Noah, looking back, judges. What's fascinating, aside from all of these very important discussions, is the fact that once we see these psukim are referring to Noach and his generation, and they did all those things, and va'ani means what it needs, and means and Hashem performed kindness to Noach and said, va'ani v'ruchastecha v'visecha. What's most striking about this pasuk now is that he refers to the ark as Hashem's house. We normally understand it refers to a shul. We say it when we come into shul, or the Beis HaMikdash, or something like that. And Noach said it as a reference to Hashem bringing him into the teva. What does that tell us? It tells us, as a mefarshim, that there is a dimension to Noah's ark that perhaps we may not have been aware of otherwise. Everything was in the ark. Every living thing, including HaKadosh Baruch Hu, including the Shechina. The Teva is called Hashem's house because the entire as far as the Hashem's relationship with the world was compacted into the Teva. And elsewhere we find similarly, commenting on the words in Tehillim, Shesulim Beveis Hashem, transplanted into Hashem's house, says the Medrash, that's Noach and his family. They were transplanted into the Teva. They were originally planted, their roots were in the world, they became transplanted into Hashem's house. That's why the famous comment of the Medrash, which Rashi quotes later on, Hashem assures Noach that the natural running of the constellations and of the planetary systems will continue unabated. Kayetz v'chom, kor v'chor, v'yom v'layla, lo yishbosu. Nothing will stop, says Rashi, because for this year it did stop. That year, nothing moved. Melamed shelo shimshu hamazolos. This teaches us the constellations did not operate during that year. What is the significance of the mazolos not operating? Says the Shem Yishmuel, the function of mazolos specifically refers to the fact that the divine flow comes from on high through the agency of the mazolos. That's the word mazol comes from the word nozel. Nozel means to flow, and therefore mazolos is that which allows for the flow of divine energy to come into the world. When you wish a person mazel tov, that's really what you're saying. They should have a positive flow of divine energy. If you say that, they might not really understand what you mean. So mazel tov is preferable, but that's what it means. But mazolos, therefore, are the conduit for Hashem's supervision, so to speak, and his influence into the world. Says the Shem Yishmuel, during the year of the flood, there was no world. Nothing was happening in the world. The only going concerns lived in the Teva, and so did HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which means that they were affected directly. So the whole system of the mazolos was redundant for that year until things expanded back again into the global running of the world. And thus we find, it's a fascinating aspect of the Teva. The Teva was Beis Hashem, Shesulim Beveis Hashem. We find that Atzei Gofer are defined in the Gemara in Maseches Rosh Hashanah as a type of cedar wood. Cedar wood is what the Mishkan was made from. That means the Teva is made from the same materials as the Mishkan. And moreover, when the Pasuk says, Asei Lecha, and the emphasis is on Noach, says the Netziv, this is a parallel to the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu was the one, only Moshe, was the one who was told to set up the Mishkan initially. And by the same token, says Netziv, Noach, his children did not help him, it seems according to Rashi. Only Noach, because Noach was on a higher level than all of them, certainly some of them, but even Shem ben Noach. And therefore, the sensitive nature of preparing the Teva as the Beis Hashem required that only Noach be involved, as surely as later on that only Moshe be the one to set it up. And there's a further interesting parallel when the Pasuk says, V'zeh asher ta'aseh sa Teva, which is in Pasuk Tesvav, this is how it should look like. We know the word Zeh always refers to something that you can point to. And when you're talking about an idea, how can you point to an idea? Well, later on we find that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu talks to Moshe about certain parts of the Mishkan and says V'zeh, it means he showed him what it looked like. V'zeh ma'aseh ha-menorah. He showed him what the menorah would look like. Say the Mefarshim, V'zeh asher ta'aseh osa, is HaKadosh Baruch Hu showing Moshe, showing Noach what the Teva would look like. And you have, therefore, in the way that it became assembled, many parallels between the Teva and the Mishkan, because the Teva, the full profile of the Teva, ultimately served as a Mishkan as well. Avo Beisecha. How did we get here? And how will this help us answer our original question? In the beginning of Parshas Truma, when the Torah lists the components and ingredients for the Mishkan, Zahav, Kesef, Nechoshes, Tcheles, Agamon, and all of those things, the final things mentioned are, or of the final things, Shemen Lamaor, oil for the lighting. Shemen Lamaor. The Dasakeni Mibali HaTosfos raises a simple question. What is the oil for the lighting doing on the list of items at the beginning of Parshas Truma? The beginning of Parshas Truma is about the building of the Mishkan. You don't need oil to build the Mishkan. It's not part of the construction. It's part of the ongoing function. It's one of the mitzvahs of the Mishkan. But it's not part of the construction of the Mishkan. The Pasuk doesn't make reference to flour for the Lechem Haponim, for example, because you don't need that to build the Mishkan. That's just something that happens when the Mishkan is running. So why in the component parts of the construction of the Mishkan does it mention Shemen Lama'or? That is the question. And the answer, say Tosfos, is because the definition of building is that which allows whoever is meant to dwell there to dwell there. And now, what do you need in order to make a place fit for habitation? It might depend. If it's a very primitive structure, if it's serving someone with minimal needs, so to speak, or minimal purpose, very little, just four walls and a roof. However, says the Tosfos, when you build a house for a king, the king will not enter the house if there's no lights on. You can't say, well, you're capable of entering, just walk carefully. If it's a binyan of kavod, there's no kavod without light. And therefore, as a house for the king, in terms of our experience, the Mishkan is not fully constructed until the menorah is lit. And that means that the oil for the lighting is part of the materials for construction as surely as the wood and the gold, the silver and the copper. And that's what's on the list in the beginning of Parshas Truma. That's a fascinating insight. For we see that when it comes to the Mishkan, light is not considered to be a luxury item. It's considered to be part of what is now considered to be built. And now perhaps we may suggest Acharei Hadvarim Ha'ele, but this is why the instruction of Tzohar Ta'ase La'Teva, which may be a window, or maybe a luminous stone, it is to be found in the earlier group of psukim which describe the construction of the Mishkan. Our question was, doesn't that tell us that it's something that involves construction? Which would clearly be a window, not something that you bring in, because if it's something you bring in, that should be with a later, once it's already been built. But once we appreciate that the Tevas Noach had the status of Mishkan Hashem, Avo Beisecha, and once we further note that when it comes to the Mishkan, the materials for illumination are rated and grouped together with materials for construction, that means that the Tzohar is correctly placed in the early psukim with the construction, even if it physically took the form of a luminous stone, as surely as if it took the form of oil that was to be burnt. And thus, that piece of evidence, which seemed to be very compelling in one direction, is neutral. It could yet go either way, and Rashi quotes and mentions both explanations. So this, I believe, is a suggestion to respond to that particular question. We're not going to get that far into the Parsha this evening, I don't think. But let's move to Pasuk Yud Zayin. Va'ani hineni mevias hamabul mayim al ha'aretz. I will bring a flood, says Hashem, the shachez called basar, in order to destroy all flesh. It's the mabul. Rashi comments on the opening words of the pasuk. Va'ani hineni mevi. I am now going to bring the mabul. Says Rashi, hineni muchan lahaskim. I'm finally prepared to agree. Im osam shezerzuni, with those who urged me originally, va'amur lefanai kvar, and they already told me from way back when, ma'enosh kitis kered, what is man that you should remember him? The reference is to a group of malachim who went up to Baruch Hu, said nase adam, and he's consulting with the malachim. That we know. Rashi tells us it's derech eretz. Should consult with those around you. So he did. We never really found out what they responded. We just know that they were consulted. Well, actually, the Gemara talks about it in the fourth Perek of Sanhedrin, and there were different factions amongst the Malachim, and some said, it doesn't really sound like a good idea. I mean, they asked for a man to be described, and the more he was described, the less of a good idea it sounded. And they said, Ma'enor shkitiz kerenu. And Hashem still created man. And now he says, but you know, seeing as what's happened, I'm prepared to agree with those malachim who said, Ma'enor shkitiz kerenu. Theologically, this is a bomb, this Rashi. But of course, as is often the case, that's not Rashi's problem. Now, the Rashi's problem is the pshat and the pasuk. The ideas that we're left to grapple with, that's our problem. Rashi, in the meanwhile, moves on to the next pasuk. So the way to understand these opening words, Va'ani hinani mevi, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I'm prepared to agree with them because they said not to create man and they were right. Why does Rashi say all of this? I mean, the words just describe HaKadosh Baruch Hu doing something. How do we know that he is prepared to agree to someone else who's already said something? Where do we find this reactive, quote-unquote, element in the words? Well, the word va'ani, the vav, once again, of va'ani, means there's others in the equation. Va'ani. But that's not enough, because even if there's others in the equation, perhaps they are brought along. It doesn't mean that they are provide the initiative, so to speak, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu responds. Whenever the word va'ani is to be found, or va'hashem, it's va'hashem u'beis dino. It doesn't mean that he is following his bezdin. Normally he's leading his bezdin, whatever that means. So the word va'ani doesn't yet tell us that he is agreeing with a group of malachim. Well, what about the word hineni, or hineni? Because hineni does have the connotation of I'm prepared to do something that is asked of me, hineni. The problem is hineni here also doesn't necessarily mean that. Hineni normally means that if it's a response to something. Hashem said to Avram, Avram, and Avram said, hineni. If the pasuk refers to someone being called and they respond, hineni, or Yaakov says he calls Yosef, and Yosef says to Yaakov, hineni, within that context is a response. But if the word hineni starts, then it just means this is something that I'm doing. When Paro describes his dream to Yosef in the beginning of Miketz, he says, in my dream, hineni el medos vasayor. That's just what I was doing. That's hineni, hineni. He wasn't responding to anyone. He wasn't agreeing to anyone. He was just standing there. Because it's at the beginning. So this pasuk is at the beginning. So where do we see anywhere a connotation of Hashem agreeing, so to speak, to the malachim? The answer says, the Be'er Yitzchak, is if you look at either of these two words, va'ani and hineni, you won't get it. But you have to look at both of them together, because that's where it comes from. It's because the pasuk says va'ani and then says hineni that there's a responsive element coming out. And the reason why is because hineni is actually a contracted form of the words hineani. So if hineni is hineani, so how can you say hineani if you just said va'ani? That jars. There's a redundancy. That further pushes out the word hineni to a responsive connotation that it otherwise wouldn't have had. If the word hineni is all you have, so it just means, here, this is what I'm doing. But if ani is me, and hineani is me again, so that bears out the reactive element aspect of the word hineni, and that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I am prepared to agree to the malachim. They said, don't create him, it's not worth it, and they're right. Now, methodology of Rashi aside, the Ramban has a very basic question on this. Well, it's on the Medrash, but Rashi quotes the Medrash. What's Rashi saying? That what I'm about to do is to agree to the Malachim. I asked the Malachim, Nase Adam, shall we make man? Let us make man. And they said, doesn't look like a good idea. I didn't listen to them, but now I will listen to them. Says Ramban, but he's not listening to them. Even now he's not listening to them. Because to listen to them would actually be more effectively achieved by not telling Noah to build the ark and just bringing the marble without any warning. And then everyone would have been destroyed. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is actually making provisions for the continuance of the human race. It's currently down to 8, but within the course of time, the world will be populated again with exactly the type of people that the Malachim said shouldn't be there. So it doesn't sound like Hashem is listening to the Malachim at all. They said, don't create man, and he is giving man a way to continue to live. Laharbos zaro, ka'afros tevel, as we say in Musaf and Rosh Hashanah. So it doesn't sound like he's listening. That's the kasha of Rambam, which is a very difficult question. Says the Be'er Yosef, to understand what Rashi means to say. When it comes to an assessment of the situation in the generation of the flood, we find certain statements from Chazal based on Psukim that are very startling for us. And we know that people began to misbehave. They were terribly corrupt. Okay, people can choose, and they chose badly. Ki yishchis kol basar astarko asa'aretz. But the more we look in the Psukim and the more we scrutinize the Psukim, the more we'll see that it wasn't just man. It was everything. When it says, ki hishchis kol basar es darko es ha'aretz, all flesh, Rashi comments, everything. Animals were intermating, and the whole nature of everything had been corrupted. And that already needs to be reckoned with, because an animal doesn't have free choice. So how exactly could they act in this corrupt way? All an animal has is its nature. And moreover, the Medrash says further, even the land was corrupt. Things did not grow properly. It must be that what happened was that man had an effect on the world that was so powerful that when he corrupted his nature, he succeeded in corrupting the nature of the entire world. Completely. Which means that every other echelon of and sphere of existence was a reflection of the corrupt nature of man. And that's why the punishment took the form of a mabul. I mean, it literally was a kind of a laundering process of the world, just to purge the world itself. That's why when the Pasuk says Yud Gimel, Hashem says, Hineni mashchisam es ha'aretz, I will destroy them es ha'aretz. So again, the pshat of es ha'aretz means I will destroy people from the world. But es ha'aretz more literally means with the world. That means that Hashem also destroyed, as Rashi says, the outer layer of the world also had to go. That outermost layer, that had also been contaminated. The world had to be cleansed itself. How is man capable of doing this? The answer is, says the Be'er Yosef, this is a result of the power that HaKadosh Baruch Hu had given man initially. Not only can he choose, but his choices will impact thoroughly, completely, on every level of existence. And, says Be'er Yosef, if we look carefully, we will see this is really what the Malachim were objecting to. After all, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, Na'aseh Adam. And the Malachim say, well, you know, he could make a lot of mistakes. Doesn't really sound like it's a good idea. I mean, they're angels. That doesn't sound like a very angelic response. Live and let live. If he makes a mistake, that's his problem. But the point is that originally, if he made a mistake, it was everyone's problem. The Malachim, their own existence is threatened by his downfall. They say, Mo enosh ki tizkerenu, what is man that you should remember him? Uven Adam ki tifkedenu. And son of man ki tifkedenu. Tifkedenu means that you give him this position of prestige. He's a pakid. In the powerful sense of the word. As the next pasuk says, Tamshilehu, this is from Tehillim Perikres, Tamshilehu b'masi adecha, you give him control over your world. Kol shato tachas ragla, everything you have placed under his feet. That's what the Malachim are saying. So they have no problem, as long as man and his mistakes remain contained in a vacuum, so good, isn't it? But if it will affect everything, So then they have their reservations. HaKadosh Baruch Hu initially gave man the entire power. And now he says, Va'ani hinini. I am now, so to speak, reconsidering. They said, Ma'anish ki says karenu, and I'm inclined to agree with them. Man was given the choice. It almost destroyed the world. And now I'm agreeing with the Malachim. But what does that mean? It means that decisive action will be taken. Because from now on, man no longer has that power. He can still survive. He can still live. He can still populate the earth. But he doesn't have that power that he had originally. And that's why the Pasuk goes on to say in Perek Ches, Pasuk Kaf Aleph, as Noach brings his korbanos, Hashem says, I will never again lo osif od lekalel es ha'adama bavur ha'adah. I will never again destroy the world because of man. Now, what is behind that statement, after all? If chas v'chalila, the human race deserves it, why should it not happen the second time, as surely as it happened the first time? We hope it never reaches that, but what would change? The answer is, says Be'er Yosef, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has taken away the power from people, so that they're not capable of having the world destroyed over their wrongdoings. It is true, of course, that people's actions do affect the world. That is the very concept of Tzelem Elokim, according to the famous Reb Chaim Bevolozhin, and indeed the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos in the beginning of the fifth Perek. Tzadikim are mekayim in esa olam shenivra basar ma'amaras. They uphold the world. Risharim are me'abdin esa olam shenivra basar ma'amaras. Risharim destroy the world. So there is an effect, but it is much diminished. It is no longer total. It's significant, but it's no longer total in that way. And interestingly, this brings us to the sign that is given to Noah, to mankind, after the Mabel. That's the sign of the rainbow, of the Keshes. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, when the Keshes will, in Perek Tes, Pasuk Yud Aleph, we see the words, V'hakimosi esprisi itchem, there's a covenant here, V'lo yukareis kol basar od mimei ha-Mabel, and people will not be destroyed in that way. And the V'lo yeod Mabel l'shechei sa'aretz. How does the rainbow signify this covenant? There is a covenant. Zachar Abris, it's a bracha that we make when we see a rainbow. The Ramban raises this question, for he discusses as to whether there was a rainbow before the flood. And some before Shem are inclined to say that there wasn't. For Ramban seems to understand that there was, if it's a natural phenomenon, assuming that the laws that allow for a rainbow to exist now existed before the flood, if the atmosphere wasn't fundamentally changed in that way. So there was a rainbow before, so then how does it become the sign of the bris? Says the Ramban, there were rainbows before, but it's been commandeered, so to speak. It's been borrowed to serve as the sign of the bris. But why? What does it have to do with the future of mankind? Says Ramban, two possibilities. Firstly, it's a bow without a string. In other words, it has the bow of the bow, but not the string. It's just that the rounded part. And therefore, says Ramban, when one nation conquers the other, they take the bows of the enemy and they remove the string, which essentially disarm them. And therefore, it's a symbol. It's a sign for HaKadosh Baruch Hu saying that he will not destroy the world. He removes the string from the bow. That's the first Perush of Ramban. The second Perush is that when an enemy when one army surrenders to the other, they turn the bow around. I mean, up till now, they turn the gun around. They hand the barrel first. So here, they turn the bow around. And therefore, the bow of the rainbow is not aimed downwards. Been turned around, which once again represents HaKadosh Baruch Hu not unleashing this destructive force on the world. These are the two Perushim of Ramban, each one fascinating in its own way. I wonder whether it's possible to suggest, according to the approach of the Be'er Yosef, that the significance of the bow is both of the explanations of the Ramban put together. That is to say, it is the fact that the string has been removed, but the bow is facing upwards. What that means is that man has been disarmed. He's had that power to destroy himself and his entire world taken away from him. So whereas the Ramban was understanding that it's the HaKadosh Baruch Hu who's taken the string out of his bow, so to speak, as in terms of the result of the mabul, there will be no mabul, but the root of the issue is that the string was taken out of man's bow. He's not capable of precipitating such a situation. And it's interesting that this agreement is called a bris. The strict interpretation of a bris is that each side brings something to the equation. A bris is a covenant, or bala'az, a deal. When a bris is cut, the reason why it's called koris a bris is because each side is cut. That is to say, each side loses something, which it brings, that's what it brings to the table, that's what it brings to the other side. So if a bris is one-sided, it's not a bris. As we know, if you've read the news recently. So the concept of a bris, therefore, is that each side, in return for what one side does, the other side pledges equally. The Torah, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, says, Im Shamoa Tishmu, that's bris Torah. If you keep the mitzvahs, then the positive results will be that each side brings something. So if that's the case, then the question is, so how can the rainbow be called a bris? It's a one-sided agreement. It seems that only HaKadosh Baruch Hu is giving something up, so to speak. That is to say, he's the only one who's doing anything, who's pledging anything. He's pledging that he will never bring a mabul. But the human race doesn't seem to be bringing anything to the covenant, because it sounds like it can do what it wants, and still nothing will happen. But that's not a bris. That's unilateral. But based on the Ber Yosef, I think we understand that both sides gave something up. In other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, his pledge is that he will never bring another mabul, but we also gave something. We gave the power that we originally had. We lost it. We forfeited it for the benefit of the safekeeping of the world. So these are fascinating insights into life before the mabul, life after the mabul. And just a final point to consider, and this is only Reb Shlomo Fischer could say what is about to be said. But the closest thing we find to the very extreme reaction of the Dor HaMabul is in Eretz Yisrael. We find, for example, the city of Sodom, based on Averus alone, was overturned. And Ramban says that they may not have been the most evil city in the world. Had they been in Chutz La'aretz, it could be that the city wouldn't have been overturned. But not in Eretz Yisrael. You can't, a city like that can't exist in Eretz Yisrael. And moreover, the Tochacha is all about the volatile and very sensitive nature, not volatile, sensitive nature of life in Eretz Yisrael. Things impact very quickly. It almost sounds like whatever happened post the Mabul didn't happen as much in Eretz Yisrael. Whereas the land will never be affected by people's wrongdoing, but the land of Israel will be affected by people's wrongdoings. What happened? Says the Shlomo Fischer, this undertaking that the land will never be affected by people's wrongdoings was post-Mabul. But the Mabul never happened in Eretz Yisrael. Lo gushma b'yom zam. And therefore, if it never happened, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I'll never do it again, it doesn't necessarily apply to the place that he never did it in the first place. And thus Eretz Yisrael retains this sensitive quality. And he follows up with such a fascinating comment. There's a bracha to be made. When one sees a rainbow, Zochei Habris, Neman Rebiso, Kayim B'Ma'amara. The Gemara says in Maseches, Brochus and Dafnun Tes, B'Ma'arova Amri, Bruchi Vadim Mevarchi. In Ma'arova, Ma'arova is Eretz Yisrael, from the point of Bavel, Eretz Yisrael is to the west. In the west, they say that we certainly make a bracha when we see a rainbow. The question is, everyone knows brachas, not just in Eretz Yisrael. How come this message had to come from Eretz Yisrael? Says the Shlomo Fischer, because there exists a hava amina, a strong reason to presume that if people in Eretz Yisrael saw a rainbow, they wouldn't make a bracha, because it's about a bris that doesn't apply to them, because it's post-Mabul, and the Mabul never happened in Eretz Yisrael. And that's why it's a stunning chiddush. Even in Ma'arovah, they make a bracha when they see a rainbow, because tachlis, they are part of the world. But nonetheless, Eretz Yisrael retains this sensitive quality, and in a sense, that's a tribute to the power of correct conduct here in Eretz Yisrael, but certainly, once again, to be circumspect with regards to Chas V'Shalom doing anything that shouldn't be done. This remains our special relationship with Eretz Yisrael that we hope will reach its fruition in the Geula Shelema Meher B'Yameinu.